For as long as I can remember, I've found myself searching. Searching for meaning, for understanding, and trying to find the true essence of who I am. To make sense of all of the knowledge that's out there, and how I could use that to be the best version of myself. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, and professionally. Through my own experiences and conversations with inspiring people sharing their authentic stories, I've realized that the answers to some of life's most challenging problems often lie in very simple messages. So join me on a journey of discovery where I speak to real people with real stories sharing real insights. I'm Sanjeev, and you're listening to my podcast series, Just Another Lens. Welcome to our next episode of Just Another Lens with Pratik Gadia from the Yarn Bazaar, all the way from Bangalore today.
Yes.
Welcome to the latest episode of Just Another Lens. So Pratik, for the listeners out there, the viewers out there who don't know you, tell us a little bit about Pratik Gadia today and the Yarn Bazaar and who you are.
So firstly, Sanjeev, thank you so much for having me here. So I run a startup called the Yarn Bazaar. What we're trying to do is, there's a large legacy textile industry, which is massive, massive in size, but highly broken in terms of the supply chain, highly fragmented. It's a primarily an unorganized space, so very archaic in nature. We're trying to streamline the entire supply chain from pre-sales to post-sales, so kind of solving for this problem of broken supply chain in textiles, by creating a managed marketplace for textile yarn buyers and yarn suppliers.
Okay. So that's your business model. That's your marketplace. But for me, if anybody Googled Pratik Gadia, they would see all of these videos of Shark Tank India,
right,
where this confident young man is standing in front of five sharks. Now, today you're an incredibly successful role model. You're very humble, and you come from values that I can really relate to. So as much as this is who you are today and what your business is today, what I'm hoping we'll do is if we start at the beginning.
Sure.
You know, there's a school of thought that says whatever deck of cards you're dealt with when you're born determines your future.
Right.
And through my years and my conversations, my own journey and others, I know that's not true. I know implicitly that, sure, you have to recognize your deck of cards, but then how you play them is up to you. And so let's understand your deck of cards. I come from, when I think back to where I relate to my grandfather who had moved to East Africa and worked on the railways. So if we start back at you with you, tell me about your family heritage and where that started, and let's take the listeners through that journey.
Sure. So I agree with what you said. While there's one thing I don't agree with is the success part.
Okay.
I think it's still a journey. But yeah, so my family comes from a small town in Rajasthan, which is the northern part of India. It's a small village called Jhunjhunu. So the closest landmark to that is Pilani, which is where BITS Pilani is, a very well-known tech institute in India.
Okay. I'd never heard of BITS Pilani until about 5-10 years ago, but
okay.
I understand it's a very highly respected tech institute in India.
Right. So apart from the IITs, BITS Pilani is one of the other well-known tech institutes there.
Okay.
So that's pretty close to Jhunjhunu. My dad grew up, I would say, as a rebel. Amongst all his siblings, he was the youngest one. Okay. And there were quite a few of them. So he was not great in studies. And I think at a very early age, he realized that, you know, that's not something that he meant to do. So at the age of around 15 years old, he ran away from that village, went all the way to Nepal.
Okay. This is your father's. Okay, so Your grandfather was doing what in the village?
So we have a very, very old family shop, which is a FMCG, jo kirana shop, it's called as. So it's where people go and buy staples.
So,
sure.
Yeah, the little store.
Yes.
But okay, in trade, but in a small way, your grandfather. And you're saying your father was a rebel. He didn't like
He would end up going to this shop or spend his day there. But apart from that, he was just always with his friends and chilling. So that's when he got tired of that life, ran away to Nepal. There was some cousin that he knew there, which had a sari shop, right? Okay. So sari is this Indian attire, which most women wear. He joined the shop as a salesman. So he's been traveling till he settled in Bombay. So from Nepal, then he got married, shifted to Calcutta, which is on the eastern side of India. From Calcutta, that's where my elder sister was born. And then he moved to Bombay, Mumbai. So he's had this journey where, you know, he started with very little money with him. Slowly graduated to running a commission agency business. So him acting as a broker for textile fabrics. And from there, he rose up the rank. And then around 2005, he started his fabric manufacturing business. So growing up in that kind of a scenario where, you know, you've seen your father all kind of hustling it out to, you know, make ends meet to ensure that they give the best to their children. So I have two siblings, elder sister, younger sister. And growing up, I think, you know, like you said, deck of cards. I think my mom actually played a very, very important role in shaping my early career.
In what way?
So since I was very young, she wanted to ensure that, you know, I become a all-rounder. And in the sense that, for example, she made sure I was very active in sports. So under 12 football team, center football, then joined the cricket team also. For a brief period, I was the captain of the cricket team, joined the athletics team also, joined the basketball team also. So I think in school, I've probably played every sport that our school had to offer. So there was always this push of, you know, having to do everything. In studies, I wouldn't say I was brilliant, but I was not bad either.
So let me just understand this. This is your father's broken way as a rebel. So I can't be living here. I don't see my future like this. He set off and moved hundreds of miles away to Nepal, where he joined a family who was running a sari shop. But he never stopped still there. He wanted to do his own thing. It was clear that was in him. And eventually when you settled down in Mumbai with your younger and elder sisters, you talk about your mother making you an all-rounder, ensuring that you're an all-rounder. But it's interesting, you're talking about sports. When you're talking about all-rounder, what I hear a lot, and I hear it whether it's in India, from South America, Eastern Asia to wherever, traditional families or families nowadays are so determined to ensure their children, their young ones, are competitive and all-rounders. But you're not mentioning particularly academic when you're talking about it, or the emphasis isn't there. So is that a deliberate thing? Was that a conscious thing that your mum did? Or
so, see, both my parents have not really studied a lot, right? My dad's just done like 10th standard. My mom has just done 12th.
Yeah, what age in India would you finish 10th
standard? So my dad left study at 15.
Okay.
My mom completed till 17.
So for UK terms, that's secondary school. So
yes,
GCSEs, maybe first year A or second year A level. So Right. The normal basic level of education.
So of course they wanted all their children to, you know, excel in the studies, and I think we fairly did, but they never really got involved very closely to, you know, how are we studying, or, you know, how great we are, as long as the grades, I mean, it was always the grades that mattered.
I like that, right? So that really reminds me of my dad. Sorry, I have to say this. Beautifully, they never got really involved in the studies, as long as the grades were there.
Exactly.
That's what was it, right? Have your grades come out? When's your exam? Have your grades come out? But what was that like in terms of your grades? Where did you sit in that whole competitive environment that you're in? Were you particularly smart? Were you a high achiever?
if I try to learn something, it comes easy or it comes naturally. So I never had to like sit and spend hours, studying. As long as I would just spend a few hours before the final exam, I knew that I could like get fairly decent grades. So there were a few subjects, like for example, maths, I would probably score I would have hardly lost a few marks in maths and science.
Okay.
Right. So without having to study much, the rest of the languages again, or the rest of the subjects, didn't struggle. So was between, let's say, 75 or around 75%, which is not bad. So not great either.
I like the way not bad. It's all relative. It's all relative. That's why I said to you, in your competitive environment, I hear about... I speak to a lot of people. For the last 10 years, I've been able to take cohorts of international master's students, as I said, from across the world. And in those pockets where they've come from, to get to the elite schools, elite universities, you'd have to be a top 90s right. plus type of performer, which is incredibly competitive, but you're talking about a comfortable 70 something is okay, but no pressure from home?
There was pressure, but again, like I said, it was not just about studies, right? So again, from an early age, I used to go to my dad's office also during summer vacations. So how my dad has seen himself growing up and having to go to his dad's shop, there was always an expectation that, you know, this is how we've grown up and this is how our kids should also grow up.
So your dad's experience... Again, it's how it conditions what he thinks, yes. the pathway forward, right? We all tend to do that. What we've learned from is the way we kind of go and use that learning to play it forward. So your dad, having created it himself, hustled himself, and your mother particularly, say, let's build an all-round, let's support them to be all-rounders. So, okay, so from that journey, what were the dynamics like, expectations like between... the siblings?
No, I don't think we were even similar at all.
Okay, so tell me about that.
I think study-wise, probably amongst the three of us, I think I was better than my sisters. In terms of socializing, I think my sister was much better than probably I still am today.
What about the parental expectation?
So I think, again, it could be a cultural thing. What I have seen in my experience, a lot of Indian, especially business-oriented Marwadi, Gujarati, Hindu families, there are always higher expectations from the son. I don't know, maybe there are multiple reasons to that, but there's always a differentiation between the two genders. So the bar was always set high for me. Right, because I mean, you know, there's a typical saying for daughters that, you know, they're going to be around for only for a short while.
It's a reality, right? Let's not beat about the bush. It's a reality that parents have, for various reasons, expectations, and from a cultural lens, the expectation sometimes on the elder sibling, sometimes if it's a son compared to a daughter. There's this reality that many people grow up with, even today, that you're expected to do what differently? Tell me what that is. What was that expectation? What kind of expectation on you?
Yeah, so like, for example, now we as a society, I think, has evolved a lot, right? But while we were growing up, we wouldn't have imagined our parents being okay with my sisters working after studies, right? That was not a very normal thing back then.
Okay.
And I think we've evolved a lot. And both my sisters, after completing their graduation, they had fair share of experience before they even went on to do their post-grad. So again, expectation-wise, while I was growing up, the expectation from me in terms of being slightly better in studies was always higher. Right? Because they always felt that one day, whatever my dad's building, it's me who has to then take it forward from there.
Has to.
No choice given.
Again, when I have conversations, there are people who find themselves in a situation where their parents have set up something, have a business, something ongoing concern. And how they look at that can be very different. So about your father's business, was that particularly something that you were looking forward to taking on when you were?
Absolutely, absolutely. I was fairly clear with respect to my trajectory also. So I had seen that amongst my extended families, amongst my cousins, there was a set pattern amongst the established ones that after completing their graduation, they would join their family business full time, spend a couple of years there. And then there's a program called FMB, Family Managed Business. So it's like an MBA, but meant for family business owners.
Really? Tell me about that, because I haven't heard of that.
Okay. So there are a few institutes in India, a couple of them fairly known, SPJN, NMIMS, which have designed a program around family business owners, young generation.
So SPJN and?
NMIMS, Narsimhanji.
NMIMS, okay.
Right. These are two of the better known ones. It's a 1-year program or it could be a 2-year program, depending on how they structure it. But typically meant for family business owners only. And the program is slightly fine-tuned to address the challenges that a family business would have compared to a corporate world or any other environment.
What kinds of things, now that you've been through much more of the journey of different academia, what kinds of things do they cover in this kind of course that makes it stand out, particularly for family businesses? What kinds of things do they cover?
I know a fair share of it. I don't know a lot about it because then I decided not to do that. And
didn't go down that path. Okay. So from what you know, what kind of things were there?
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, is common amongst most of these family businesses is the generation gap. So how do you manage, two different generations, one being your elder one and one yourself, where both these generations could have like completely different or varied thoughts, right? And with respect to how do you do this or how do you do it? How do you run the business in short? And one of the things I teach you there is like how do you take care of these kind of situations?
Interesting. I don't know how much involvement the sort of senior generation have in that education process, because I'd be intrigued to understand, okay, they'll be talking to your generation about how you would take over the family business. But that's one side of the conversation, the equation.
Right.
how invested are the parents' generation? I don't know. Do you know anybody who's been through that at all?
Yeah, a lot of my friends, most of my cousins, a lot of my friends. So the idea was to do that. So again, I finished my graduation, joined my family business. I think 6 months in the business and I realized I can't do this. I just can't do this. I mean, I knew that I didn't want to like continue with the textile business.
Okay.
Initially, it was a lot of struggle, to be honest with you, to even have that discussion at home. Because, you know, it was always a clear journey that this is what I would do. And having spent some time there, I realized not something that I really want to do.
So standing from your father's perspective, parents, sure, we've worked hard, we've got here, we've hustled, we've established. Natural thing is, Pratik is going to be taking over this business. You're happily playing along. You're going to help out in the business in your vacations. You're going all the way down that path. You've done your undergrad. And then 6 months later, you're thinking,
no.
So tell me about how you broke it to your family. How did that conversation go?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. And I think what helped is I knew it won't be easy.
Okay.
So, see, because most of these societies or families are driven by lineage, right? So, you know, that's how it's always been. I think to some extent, I was also very adamant. Tried convincing and finally was able to convince.
Okay, let's break it down a little bit. So you knew it wasn't going to be easy. Preparation, understand what you're going to be going into. Can you remember any of perhaps the first conversation or the first opening up of this thought of a different direction? Can you recall any of that?
Yeah, so I've had a playbook. Whenever I'm in such situations, I always lean back on my elder sister.
Aha.
And she's
okay.
the one who helps me out. So I reached out to her. I remember I was on a trip with a couple of my friends. So again, at an early age, I got into music, and I fell in love with thrash metal music. So Metallica, Megadeth.
Okay.
So I was a big fan of Metallica. 2011, they came down to India to play, which we would have never imagined. So they had one gig in Mangalore, which is where I had gone with a couple of my friends. And this is around the time when I was working with my father, you know, that break between graduation and this FMB program. So I still remember that phone call. I called my elder sister from there, I think a day after the show. And I told her, listen, you know, this is what it is. And I'm really not looking forward to, a long continuation in the family business. And just help me out here.
Okay.
And I remember I cried also on the phone.
Bless you.
So yeah, reached out to her, and then she would have done her magic thing, which is something she always does. And yeah, then we sat down as a family, and I said, I don't feel like doing FMB. And it was actually around that time, I read an article by Paul Graham, one of the founders, or very popularly known for founding Y Combinator, YC, right? It was an article that I was completely blown away by. And that's when I was bitten by the startup bug.
Okay, two parts of this. You owe your sister a lot, my friend. So you went to the mediator. You knew who the mediator was going to be.
Yes.
You had a good relationship with her, and she laid the groundwork for having that conversation. But you mentioned this article by the founder of Y Combinator. So what was it about that sort of appealed to you so much?
So Paul Graham started writing a lot of blogs around, I think, 2008, 2009. And Y Combinator, from the time it started, they had a great run, right? So a lot of these established startups, whether it's Airbnb, Stripe, a lot of these guys are actually out of Y Combinator.
Okay, rewind. For those who don't know, the audience are people who I'm sure who are listening. Everything from people who want to change direction. Maybe they're in a corporate career. Maybe they're in academia going down this path and can't see themselves there. So they want to go down the entrepreneurship path. To people who have started that journey and potentially even looking for how do they understand growth? Where do they get funding from? So Y Combinator? For those who don't know, break that down for us. What is Y Combinator?
Sure. So it's a startup incubator based out of Silicon Valley.
Okay.
What they do is every year they would invite application. They would shortlist not more than, I think, 15, 20 startups in that one batch or that one cohort. And the way they shortlist is the founders have to submit a 2-minute video. Now imagine a 2-minute video the founders having to submit describing what they are intending to build. So it's not easy. Right, they receive massive number of applications, but it is said that it's tougher to get into YC than any Ivy League across the world, right? It's a very short program, I think about 3 months or so. Again, could be slightly shorter, slightly longer, but around 3 months. I'm not too sure about the tenure. And at the end of that time, there's a demo day, which is when all of the startups would present on a stage, pitch to potential investors. Their demo day today attracts, you know, some of the most successful startup investors, and a lot of them end up, you know, getting their first check. So the way they operate as an incubator is if you're a budding startup founder, have someone with a great idea or a great concept you want to build, as part of the incubation process, which is a very short process, the one thing they help you do is manage to get week-on-week growth to at least show a PMF, which is a product market fit, to show an early validation to your idea.
Wonderful. So that's what Y Combinator do. What within that excited you?
Yeah, so this one article that Paul, this blog that he had written, spoke about what is a startup and, you know, why is it that there are certain companies who call them a startup and certain companies who don't. And the crux of that blog was the main essence of a startup is the week on week growth, which is about 5 to 6%.
Week on week.
Week on week.
Wow.
And I was 2021, this is around 2011. And I read that, and having spent a few months in the family business, having seen that, you know, how family business, the way they grow, they're probably happy with a 5-6% growth year on year.
We've got to the heart of it.
Right. So
we got to the heart of it.
So I was completely blown away by that. You know, got sucked into that world, started reading more about what startups are. And, you know, that's when in India also, that journey had just started. So Flipkart had just started around that time, right? They're today one of the most successful startups from India, but they started around that time. And that's when I started doing some more research or looking around. And that's when I came across these master's program called Innovation Entrepreneurship.
Innovation Entrepreneurship, yes. Something which you came across, I came across. I kind of didn't apply for this. I remember when I came across Innovation Entrepreneurship, I was asked to, if I'd supervise some of the students for their dissertation. And I thought, well, yeah, I've got quite a few years of experience in the world of entrepreneurship. Been through the roller coaster, understood the practicalities of it. Kind of, here's the MBA teaching, but what's the practical part that we have to add to this? So that's how I came across Innovation Entrepreneurship at Warwick. But what appealed to me was the practical nature. So you've had this conversation with your father about the family business. Then tell us about the next stage.
Yeah, so the idea was to go to him and present that if I'm not willing to do this, what is it that I'm doing? And by that time, I had shortlisted a few universities, including Warwick, for this program. So the idea was to do an entrepreneurship master's in the UK. Why UK? Because it's 1 year. I knew at that time convincing my family to allow their only son to travel out of the country for studies won't be easy. And even this wasn't. So 1 year was fairly easy to convince than a 2 year elsewhere. Because the first thought that came to their mind was, what if he doesn't come back?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I remember for the longest time, I had to convince my mom that, you know, I am going to come back. You know, I'm just going there for 1 year just for studies. And I also remember when I was leaving for like taking my flight to Warwick for this course. My family who came to drop me at the airport, my mom cried, like she was howling throughout that I'm leaving and I probably may not come back. So that fear for them was always there.
How did that feel for you? Because you're obviously close to your family. How did that feel at the time? This is you breaking away from the expectation.
Right.
Okay, sure. You're inspired by some great things that are happening out there in the world. You didn't know at the time what you wanted to do, right? Particularly?
I had a couple of ideas. One thing that I had a very strong conviction in, that was, in fact, my application to Warwick. So we had to submit an application, which was a business idea, which is what I had submitted. So I had a very strong conviction on this one. And it was, again, a very empathetic journey. It was a problem that I had faced and I felt that, you know, it needed a solution. How I dealt with that situation is, somewhere I knew that, you know, where they are coming from and why do they feel that way. And I knew that it's a very short-term thing, like, because I knew that I'm also aligned to coming back and there's no second thought to, like, not coming back, then, you know, it was much easier to deal with. Maybe it would have been a much more difficult thing if, you know, what I wanted to do was not aligned with what their expectation was.
Sure. So the plan was, you're going to go to Warwick and then you're coming back in to do what? To come back into the family business? What was the plan?
So the plan was to spend this 1 year in Warwick studying entrepreneurship, but mainly focusing on this one business idea which I wanted to build.
Yeah.
And come back and just get started with that.
You want to break down some of the elements. So do you want to get, without going into details of the course, but what was that journey? What were the elements that you brought together on this year?
So I think one of the things I enjoyed the most was, it was a very practical way of learning. We didn't have exams. And as far as I remember, we still don't, as part of this program at Warwick, it's all practical. So every module, there's a post-module assignment that one is expected to do, right? Which is like a mini dissertation on each modules. So the practicality of it was great. The other thing I enjoyed a lot was the simulations. Almost every module had simulations, which allows you to, like, you know, think deeper. And it's not just very hypothetical, right? Because in simulations, what happens, you're actually testing it out there.
That I can totally relate to in terms of what works. And I want the listeners out there to say, yeah, there's a lot of theory out there. Don't get lost in the theory. Take things and then get your hands involved. You don't have to end with the end product when you start a business.
Right.
Start experimenting and do it in a safe way. So Pratik, you finish this program and then you fly back.
Yes.
So tell us what happened then.
So yeah, came back with a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm that yes, getting started with this. And I think there was probably a different destiny. So this is around December 2013. I still remember that one evening, my dad and I, we sat down and there was something in the family business that needed him to actually have my support there. So he told me that from tomorrow, I expect you to come and join me in the office, and that's how it should be.
How did that feel to you, having had these conversations about taking a different pathway, having taken the path to study out overseas and get inspired, get excited? And then you come back and your father says, okay, no, but tomorrow I need you back in the business. So what were you feeling, and then what was in your mind to go forward from there?
I think the first feeling was definitely a lot of disheartening thing that, you know, this is what I didn't want to do. And now, after having spent 1 year, spent more time on the my startup idea. But then I think by the time I woke up the next morning, I've somehow probably accepted the fact and was happy, because I, like, growing up, I had seen my dad hustle a lot. And definitely, even if I would have been in his shoes, I would have expected my son to also kind of, you know, join me someday and take it forward. You know, there's always that feeling that what I have built, I want my son to, you know, multiply it.
It's very clear that this family unit was very special, very important to you. And yeah, there's different dynamics, different personalities, maybe different mindsets. But ultimately, you empathize with each other. And you are at that stage prepared to just go, okay, sure. And I think once you told me this, and if you want to share with the listeners what you set yourself out as an objective, do you want to just share what that was? Because I thought that was wow, a wow moment.
Yeah, so, you know, as I was saying, the next morning, there was one thing that came to my mind, and I knew that, you know, that now that I'm joining, I only have one objective, since I've seen him hustle so much. I mean, you know, there were times when he would not even know whether we are in 7th grade or 8th grade, right? Because he's completely busy in setting up the business on his own, traveling throughout nonstop, like probably 20 days a month. So I only had one objective, is that maybe in the next 2 years, if not more, I want him to kind of retire from that active daily business responsibilities.
For me, when you told me that the first time, it was one of those mic drop moments. You didn't want to be in this business. You wanted to do something totally different. And you convinced your father you weren't going to be doing it. And from going full circle back here, your objective is now you can stand back and look at your father, understand the world from his position. But your way to do this and your objective is not, okay, I'll carry on the business. That's one mindset approach. And it's all in the mind. It's your mindset. You set about going, you know what? I want to put this business in a position where he can retire in a couple of years' time. That says a lot about who you are, Pratik.
No, you know, I feel that once you decide to do something, you should commit to it. And only if you're completely committed, you can really justify, right? So I honestly feel that, you know, that was the only thought that came to my mind, and that should have been the only thought that comes to one's mind, right? Because once you're committing to it, just you should see it no other way.
I can imagine doing business with you. This is one of the reasons, one of the strong pillars that people want to do business with you, Pratik. This whole, if I commit to it, I'm doing it. So, okay, then take us through what happened. So you started the business, you were running the business, operating everything with a view to getting him to retire in a couple of years. So then where did the seeds of the Yarn Bazaar happen? Because I think that's where that started.
Right. So, see, while I committed to doing this, of course, the early few days and weeks are never very easy, right? Because you're coming with a very different thought that, you know, you've been working on a startup idea, the way startups are defined, what we just spoke about, right? The growth percentage there or the growth expectation there is very different. But one place where I should really, really be, appreciating my dad, he's a super smart guy. So there were a couple of things that he did well to ensure that I get completely consumed in the business. So number one, he doesn't drive. He has a driver. From the day he told me that tomorrow you're joining me in office, the driver didn't. The driver wasn't there for a month, right?
Right.
So if he has to go to office, it's me who has to drive him to office, right? So for a month, from 2nd December till 2nd Jan, I had no other option. But even if my dad has to go to office, he needs me to drive him there, right?
Smart man.
The second thing he did is the one mobile phone, and this was before WhatsApp came in. This was before no, WhatsApp had come in by that time, but I think smartphones had not really taken up that way. So that one phone we had in office, which was used for all sales marketing related work, on day one he just gave me that phone. He said, "From today you're taking up this responsibility." So no training, no nothing, right? You know, that's often we say the best way to learn how to swim is just, you know, throw someone in the pool and the fear of drowning will teach them how to swim, right?
Throw them in at the deep end.
Yeah.
Your father
So he
was,
gave me the phone.
yeah.
And the third thing my mom did very well is she made sure that every day in tiffin, right, she prepared or she made sure that, you know, there's nothing but my favorite. So that keeps me happy.
Feed the stomach, feed the soul, right?
So that's how I got completely consumed. I remember, I mean, once I started going to office, there was nothing else, right? So no other socializing, no nothing. That was what was it. Today, when I look back, and I feel probably one of the best things that could have happened to me, right? Because that gave me a lot of depth about textile as an industry, about the buyer segment and the supplier segment and the needs, desires, and problems. And having spent about 4 to 5 years doing that day in, day out, there were a lot of problems that I would face in my business or while running my business. And one of the greatest challenges that really affected the growth of our business, as also the P&L, the profit and loss aspect of it, was if we were able to source the right quality yarn at the right price and timely deliver to a factory. So the three important elements: if the quality goes wrong, or if the pricing was not right, or if the delivery was not on time, if any of these three things went off, it really had a massive impact on our business. And that was something that I would observe regularly because you had to keep buying yarn like almost every week. So it's, you know, it's a regular, very active part of the business. And having struggled there day in, day out, that's how, you know, I stumbled across this big problem statement or this white space, and that's how the Yarn Bazaar's concept was born.
When I talk to people about innovation, about entrepreneurship, about freeing themselves from the handcuffs of needing a job, I often say to them, don't try and invent a brand new concept wheel. Think about where you are. Think about what you know and use that as a basis, just like you said, of sure, if you can disrupt, the existing environment because you can see solutions, which is the direction you went in.
Right.
But at a simple level, if you master something within an environment, and if it's a big enough industry, then to free yourself from the shackles, it's quite easy to then go, okay, let me come outside and do a similar thing, but better.
Right.
Yeah. Or leaner, or more efficiently, or better customer service. It doesn't have to be something randomly totally new. And that's empowering. So from your case, in there, you're committed, you're wholeheartedly in there, but then you start to see opportunity based on your learning. I want to emphasize that you can have formal education, but we're hearing constantly from people that I speak to, is that education, constant open-mindedness and scanning the environment, scanning what's going on, getting deep to where you are, being present in that moment, will reveal how those dots can be joined up.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So tell us what you've described this cost problem. So then where did that take you in terms of then formulating a business? Because it's an established, long established industry.
Yes.
And now you're thinking, well, how do I disrupt this? What do I do that can fix this?
I actually honestly wasn't even there. So I knew that there's a massive gap in the market and something that has a massive impact on almost every textile company. So all I had was just this thought, right? I had probably not even started thinking about what the solution should look like, right? So whether we should be doing buying and selling, whether we should just be enabling buyers and suppliers, how we should be enabling them. So whether it'll be a discovery-led platform or a transaction-led platform. So, I mean, no thoughts on the business model yet. Because the first struggle I had to do was see if, you know, then what happens to the family business.
Uh-huh.
And by this time, I had, except for finance, I think whether it was production, purchase, sales, most of it, my dad was completely now free of. So I was fairly on track to achieving my objective while joining the family business. So the biggest worry was what happens to this now.
That's a reality, right? Again, in your situation, it was the family business. In a wider universal narrative, people are doing something at the moment.
Sure, yes.
They're running this business, but they've got a different idea. They're working, but they want to be in business. You've got to keep that thing rolling whilst you're exploring this and discovering that. So you're juggling that. So where did you find the time and space, and how did you approach developing this idea?
Yeah, so the first thing I did is one of my close friends, someone I met at Warwick, whose family is one of the biggest textile families in India. So first thing I did is just to get a quick validation on the thought, I shared this idea with him and he was quite excited about it. So that was my first, let's say, early validation.
Okay.
At a thought level. So a few weeks passed by. He was someone who kept regularly checking in with me. I remember this one evening I left from my office on the way home. And he called me and he told me this one statement. Idea is no one's monopoly.
Idea is nobody's monopoly.
Yes.
It's all in the execution.
Yes.
So powerful that was statement, yeah.
Yeah, that was a wake-up call for me. And I said that, you know, all this while I've been giving excuses or reasons to myself that, you know, I will get started, but I need to get started now. So one of the things I did is I found out. So by that time, Mumbai started having a few co-working spaces, you know, what WeWork is known for. So WeWork had not entered India by that time. But about an hour from my home, there was one co-working space I could come across, which was operating 24/7. Everything else that existed that time in Mumbai was only till 8 p.m. or maybe till 9 p.m. And by the time I come back home from my office, it's 9 p.m. By the time I have dinner, XYZ, it's already 10 p.m. So I taken up a desk at this co-working space. And for a month, the idea was that post-dinner, I will reach this co-working space. I'll be there by between, say, 11, 11:30 p.m. We'll spend a couple of hours there till, say, 2 or 3 a.m. trying to get started with at least some more thoughts on, you know, what this idea would look like. Then come back home, sleep, wake up next morning, go to office. And this was the routine.
You created extra space. People go, how do I find the time? You have 24 hours in a day. And you went, okay, so what am I doing with these hours where I'm not in the office? I'm at home, doing whatever I'm doing. But to follow this through, and there's no guarantee, you committed to being only working on this 11 o'clock at night to 2 or 3 in the morning and then back home, sleep, and then back out the next day with your day job, was running the family business.
Right.
So again, it's a really powerful message for people, budding entrepreneurs or people who want to see something through. You got to be willing to put it in. You got to pay the price, as one of my recent guests, Stephen Adjaye, has written about. There's nothing for free. So you went through that process, and as you started developing it, then talk us through to the next stage.
Yeah. So after a month of doing this, that's when I realized that a startup journey is not a part-time journey, right? You have to be fully committed to it. And that's when I had to take a decision that either this or that.
Okay.
Again, that difficult phase. And now it's even more difficult because by this time, like I said earlier, you know, except for finance or except for cash flow, everything else was me. And my dad was kind of had not been looking at production, marketing, sales for a fairly long time by now. So again, time for another difficult conversation.
Wow. Contextually, you'd committed to your father that I'm going to do this in such a way you get to retire in a few years. Pretty much there, except the finance part. And now you're going to have to go back to a difficult conversation, not just with your father, but how is the business running? Because like you said, you've been running it, most of it by then. So Tell us about that conversation. Or was it?
The first conversation I had, I remember it was both my parents, my mom and my dad. I told them that I feel very strongly for some concept of this kind. It does require me to be full-time at it. And it would be great if maybe we can have a very honest conversation on how we can then take care of the family business.
How did that conversation go? Was it you presenting something to them? Was it a conversation like this? Listen,
Yeah, it was just a conversation. And again, I think I was slightly heartbroken, but didn't matter much. I don't know. I was like, okay, continue to focus on the family
Hold
business.
Hold on, heartbroken because they didn't agree.
Yeah, they didn't agree, or probably I didn't take enough effort to convince them.
So, but at that stage, they weren't on board with this.
Yes.
So it was, Pratik, this doesn't make sense. What are you doing? This is all set up. So in that dynamic, you carried on with the family business.
Yeah, so again, just a couple of weeks, I think. And then one of the transactions we had done in the family business, it was a large export order that we had been chasing and we had gotten. And that entire order kind of went for a toss just because of one problem.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow. So you were able to take that critical failure in the business, the family business, and you did that. You what? Showed that back to your father and said, look.
No, in fact, so this time I changed the approach. I said, no more discussions. Now I'm fully convinced that this is it. Any which way, since a while, you know, the Warwick journey was all leading towards running my own startup or at least trying to build one. And now, while earlier I had some conviction on this problem statement, but having had one of the largest orders we've probably ever had in the business, export order, very sensitive, and that order going for a toss just for that same problem, right?
So you failed to fulfill that order because of one of the challenges that your business idea was going to fix, which is yarn supplies of the right quality at the right time at the right price. And this thing failed that in you being able to fulfill that commitment to this large order that you had. And you went, okay, we're doing this.
Yeah, so I went to my dad and said, I'm not coming to office from tomorrow onwards. I know you're not gonna like it, but that's what it is. I'll be working on this. And it wasn't easy because, and I don't know if that was the right thing to do, honestly, but I knew that there cannot be a smooth transition or an exit from that.
You know, what you're saying, I'm reflecting on this, is quite often when we have to move on, there's a realization that you have to let go. And people who are empathetic and caring, which you clearly are, that we can play it two ways. One is keep playing it until the other side agree, or what you have to let go of, they agree and it's a smooth exit. But your journey illustrates that actually you've got to have the power of your conviction and you've got to take it, believing in the bigger picture. And that's what you did, right? Despite your love for your parents and knowing what that dynamic was going to be like, you went with it. So then play the tape forward from there.
So stopped going to office on the next morning. Took up another co-work, which was slightly closer to my home, but didn't have to be 24/7 because now I was going to be there during the day. And started working upon it, started meeting with buyers and suppliers. Didn't have a great start. Honestly, struggled a lot because the idea I was presenting to the existing yarn buyers and suppliers who had been in the industry doing this day in, day out for many years and a few decades, right? Proposing a new solution, which would probably be a modern technology solution, was not something that was looked very favorably. But I knew that there is no way this will not work. What people were rejecting was the solution part of it, right? So it's like, you know what Henry Ford said, right? If he would have asked people what they want, they would have said faster horses, right? Nobody would have imagined a car. So with every conversation which was a rejection, the rejection was on the solution, right? But nobody rejected the problem statement.
Okay.
Right? People knew that this was a big problem. What they were not comfortable with was the solution part of it.
Okay. Okay, so just reinforce the depth of the problem. It's a reality. And you are clear that, I guess, that if you could fix for the problem and convince them sufficiently that that problem, that solution is operable, it works, then you'd be able to move forward. Is that about right?
Yes. And in fact, I also feel that it was great that that happened, because then it allowed me to not kind of marry myself with a solution, right? So from day one, I've had this vision, which I've still stuck to, which is solving for that big problem or the big white space. And because we've not been married to a business model or a solution, it has allowed us to pivot or, you know, like keep fine-tuning it or keep pivoting as and when required.
That bit there, I just want to emphasize again, because this is another lesson that I learned too far down the line, if I'm honest, which is don't get passionate or married to your solution. Get passionate and married to your reason why. Where do you want to make a difference and why? That's a really powerful message, and I think that applies universally in business. Something that I haven't asked you, which again came up for me when I got involved in a number of startups, or one particular one, which is in the telecom space.
Okay.
Sharing the idea, sanity checking it. People come up with an idea. The number of times I run workshops and innovation type discussions, incubators or practical workshops, they get secretive about their idea.
Yes.
So, Pratik, yes. Let's share with them what's your thoughts on that, in hanging on to your idea.
You know, now that I've spent some time in the startup world, I often come across people with two problems I've seen play out every time. One is this one. A lot of people have great ideas, but they're not comfortable sharing it Because somewhere they feel it's idea that matters the most, right? They have a fear that if I share it with more people, someone will probably steal it and, you know, this golden $1 billion idea that I have will be taken away. Yeah. I think what a lot of us fail to realize is that it's all execution. It's all execution. And it can get much better. You can shorten your learning curve by just sharing it and getting feedback from the right people throughout that journey.
If people don't take anything away from today, even this bit is gold dust. That there are countless ideas. I've had them. I'm sure you've had them. Certainly, I know lots of people around me have ideas. And we have ideas that we keep inside our heads, inside our little bubbles of conversation. Because it's one of those things, we'll work on this. It will come together. But unless you get it out there and execute, it's worth nothing.
Exactly.
And quite often, sharing it with people, they might even think it's a great idea. But have they got the time, the bandwidth, or the commitment to go and pursue that particular thing as opposed to what they're doing right now? 99.9% of the time, no. And you will occasionally get somebody who's going to try and do the same thing. Doesn't stop you.
Yeah.
Absolutely doesn't stop you. Your passion, your commitment, your dedication, your follow through, your flexibility, all of that goes into taking you through that journey.
Let's look at a very simple real life use case, right? Is a lot of folks who have great ideas, don't mind sharing also, but somehow never get started. And one of the things I've seen a common thread in all of these folks who are not getting started is that they're waiting for approval from either their parents or their family or friends or whoever it is. Right? And just because they're not getting that initial support, that kind of restricts them to get started. And that does break my heart a lot. Look at any profession. I mean, most accomplished sports people in the world would have said that, you know, their parents didn't believe in that. They wanted them to study further or have a very more predictable future, right? A safer bet, study, get a job. Look at some of the greatest musicians in the world, right? If everyone would have waited for, you know, people to give them approval to do this or to do that, today we wouldn't have so many success stories in the world.
Again, priceless gem. How, for people who are facing that struggle, and I quite openly say it's not just in business, it's in life in general, waiting for permission. So any thoughts or reflections or ways to try and overcome that where people who are facing those dilemmas?
I think, and I could be completely wrong here because I'm just speaking from my experience, I feel human beings in general, right? We are programmed or we are designed to please people around us, right? It's not easy for us to have our most inner circle not being on board with, you know, such a massive change, right? This is not a small decision. This is a very meaningful decision for most human beings. So that discomfort that we get when, you know, people around us are not on board, that kind of restricts us. And whereas entrepreneurship or any of these journeys is about taking that leap of faith, I think once you do that, once you prove that while people around you were not on board, but today once you've proven that, the same people will become your, you know, your most biggest supporters.
I'm trying to reflect on how that applies to just general life, I think. You know, life is too short. And taking ownership and responsibility of ourselves, our happiness first. It might seem off at a tangent, but I do a lot of work on mental health and wellness and relationships. And, you know, think about your own happiness, the way you look at other people's. People actually don't care as much as you think they care. Because they're worried about their own problems and their own lives. As much as they might disapprove or there might be some emotional tension, whatever. If you are clear as to what you want to do, then, you know, be kind to yourself and go pursue that, because there's no guarantee about tomorrow. So the Yarn Bazaar, let's pick back up on here again now, where you started getting this thing rolling. Right. Tell us about that part of your journey.
Sure. So by this time, I'm fully committed to building the Yarn Bazaar. We've still not figured out the business model. I think spent more than usual time figuring it out. Again, the meetings with prospective or potential buyers and suppliers, not giving a clear direction in terms of where we should go. Then one day someone advised me that, you know, the best way to get started is just to get started. I mean, you know, there's no limit to how much time you can spend doing everything else, but just get started and then nothing stops you from pivoting. So we realized that let's focus on building transactions because that's a deeper problem to solve than just discovery. And for us, defining transactions was going to a yarn buyer who's been buying yarn for many, many years, buying yarn on credit, right? So getting a 30, 60, 90 or a 120 days credit from its supplier, telling them that, hey, you know what, please consider us, but also pay us advance.
Wow.
Right? So no credit, give us upfront pre-shipment. Which meant that we had to build an incredible amount of trust and credibility.
So you had those conversations. I guess being in the industry broadly, you knew people, they knew you, although this is a different idea. And somewhere along the line, you were able to convince the first few people to take your solution.
No. So, see, what happened is the folks I was speaking to, I intentionally designed it in a way that I don't speak to the guys who know me because I didn't want their feedback to be biased. Okay. So I went there interacting with folks who, and anyway, see, my family business is a fairly smaller one. And it's not like a large setup where a lot of the industry folks would know us. So I intentionally ensured that except for the limited few who deal with us, except for them, I talk to everyone else, right? To get an unbiased, raw, honest feedback. So hence, it was super important to build in that trust and credibility, which is where... So we got started. Fortunately, we were able to convince a few buyers and a few suppliers. Took off better, much better than our expectations. Much better than our expectations, honestly. Thankful to God that it did. But right after we did get started, COVID struck most of us. And what COVID meant was our entire buyer supplier base is a manufacturing setup, right? So on the supplier side, we have companies which are manufacturing yarn. And on the demand side, we have companies which are consuming yarn to manufacture fabrics. Right? Manufacturing was shut. Business in general was shut, which meant that people would have more cash flow issues, which meant that their ability to work with us because of our payment terms that we expect them to pay us upfront, pre-shipment, would go down drastically. And also by this time, because we've at least gotten started, we've been in the market for 5-6 months. Of course, we want to scale, which means we want to reach out to a larger audience. And then establishing that trust and credibility for a larger audience becomes even more difficult.
So then what did you do?
So yeah, this was April 2020. Everything is shut. And here you have a very hungry young startup founder who is super impatient to just sit and wait for manufacturing to resume and markets to open up and this and that. So I had spent a lot of time listening to podcasts, learning a lot from them. So I thought if there's nothing else to do, maybe we should start a textile podcast. What it would allow us hopefully to do is... if we are not able to convince a few large buyers and suppliers to consider the Yarn Bazaar to buy and sell, right? Because that conversation is a very transactional conversation. What if we were to approach some of this user base saying that, you know, you built a large business on your own. There's a massive success story that needs to be out there in the larger market. You know, how you have built your own company or grown your company. Which is what, you know, the market would want to listen to and get inspired from. How about we do a podcast with you and share that story with the rest of the audience?
Wow. Wow. And so here in lockdown, you're approaching founders, senior people in these large organizations who you want as your customers, and you had them on your podcast. And what did that do for your journey after that, say when things started opening up?
We wouldn't have imagined the amount of inbound interest we were having from buyers and suppliers. Because what happened is the perception completely changed, right? So now, the Yarn Bazaar was known to many more companies because we didn't have to do a lot of marketing or sales. You have to reach out to every buyer and supplier individually, one-on-one, pitch them what you're doing and why they should buy or sell from you. Right now, the podcast allowed us to reach to a wider audience because anybody who came across any of our podcasts, and if they liked it, they would have shared it with at least a few more people. And the few more people they would have shared it with were mostly textile audience only. Right? So that automatically gave us slightly more mileage, number one. Number two, it changed our perception. So people started seeing that, you know, the Yarn Bazaar was hosting podcasts with a few successful folks in textiles. So suddenly the perception was that, you know, we are speaking to some of the big companies in textiles. So we may also be working with them, which also then gives more trust to smaller businesses that if they're dealing with, let's say, a significantly larger business, then probably I should also give it a fair shot.
Again, a pivotal moment in your journey to take adversity. You've just started 5 or 6 months trading. Everything shuts down with COVID. The whole world faced it. And yet you were calm and reflective enough to see how you could use this opportunity this time in the podcast. You've told us a story of that. And then your business grew. And I've spoken to you in the past about, okay, investment. Now, everybody who Googles Pratik Ghadia will see you on Shark Tank. We see so many of these reality programs now, whether it's The Apprentice or Dragon's Den or The Shark Tank. It seems like a very intense environment.
It is.
So how did you prepare for that? And what mindset did you go in there with, Pratik?
Honestly, I didn't. Like, honestly, I didn't. In fact, when we were asked to report to the venue a week before my actual date, I met with the business head there and I told them that, you know, while I'm shortlisted, I honestly don't feel like coming. And I gave him my reasons, you know, the exact same reasons. And
the reasons being, this is not consumer. People won't understand this. This is difficult to pitch in this environment.
Plus, we were raising as our first round, we were looking at a slightly larger round. And a Shark Tank TV format is, you know, has a, the comfortable range they have is fairly smaller to what we were also looking at raising. So that was also another reason. Of course, his reaction was, are you mad? Are you stupid? You know, of course, you should. It's going to be great. So then I had reached out to someone I knew, again, decent friend by that time, who happens to run a VC fund. And he had the same reaction. He said, are you mad? Why would you not go? And it was probably that phone call that convinced me. And this phone call was just a day before I was supposed to actually go there. So it was him who convinced me to go there. And so because I was not very enthu about either applying or actually going, I felt that, you know, I would just walk in, do my best and just walk out. So I had no preparation. I had nothing. Like, I was just there.
That's about as relaxed an approach as I can imagine. So it's stars can align. Remember I talked about the outliers earlier when we were talking. Malcolm Gladwell's book, as much as you can prepare for life, your situation, your deck of cards, there is an element in the right place at the right time with the right people, the right resources. And in this whole Shark Tank journey of yours, what you've described to me, there was some element of what was right about it. There's no pressure. In your mind, you were just going to be you. And the best version that you can take to a pitch is just no pressure. Here, what's the worst that's going to happen? Let me tell my story. it's my story, our journey. If it's going to work, it's going to work. If it's not, it's not. It's not the end of the world. And so you went in there just being you. And that shines.
Yeah, I had a great time. And probably the biggest reason for that would be because I had no expectations. I didn't have any pressure. I didn't feel like, you know, I should walk out with a deal.
And you walked out with convincing 4 sharks.
Yeah,
to take you on.
Crazy.
and I remember looking back at the episode and they're saying, are you crazy? Say yes. I mean, So you said, yep, I'll take your deal. And then what happened?
I can't change my life.
How? In what ways? Was it their money or what else changed your life from there?
I think the biggest takeaway I would say from this particular, moment in my life is it made me realize how great it is to have investors who are also founders. So when you have someone who have done something similar but have been able to achieve much more in industries where people would have expected nothing at all, and when they join you, their empathetic nature is super helpful compared to someone who's more of a financial or probably a pure financial investor at an early stage. For someone like me, who's probably not as prepared to raise a pure, you know, equity round from a VC or a startup investor, a venture capital fund.
So again, you're emphasizing the value of the investor, their experience, their connections, their insights that they bring to the party as the important part of that equation of the investor. And I look back on a time that people ask me through my journey, would you have done something differently? Most often I say, no, the ethical, moral choices I absolutely stand by. But there was a pivotal choice that I thought, in hindsight, what did I do? So in my journey, I had an investor, an entrepreneur who, you know, I had gone into a conversation at a strategic point in this business journey. And the equation was, we need this amount of money in return for this much equity, because this is what the business plan was. He loved it. He bought into this passionately. But he put a caveat in there.
Okay.
The caveat is, I'll give you half now.
Okay.
You burn this hard for 6 months. That's the stage we were at the business. Mm-hmm. We weren't as advanced as you. And he said, you need to survive. You've been living off your own resources. Take an income. This is not about money.
Mm-hmm.
So, sure. And then at that 6-month stage, if we're roughly on course, I'll give you the rest. And then we'll keep going. And then we'll figure out how to grow even more. Now, I agreed to that initially. But I remember speaking to my people around you and then getting that doubt seed.
Right.
I said, no. You can find pure investors. You can find people who can back you. You can do this. And I actually rewound the tape on that investment. Okay. And this guy kindly went, sure, if that's what you want to do. But I regret that like crazy in that journey. I realized the value of what you've described. So don't get wedded to your percentage of your business, particularly. If you've got the right investor with the right experience at the right time, they can be all the difference. It's not about the money.
Right.
So that's amazing. And I guess it gave you broadcast all around the whole market, right? So what was that experience like in terms of your growth? Where are you now since that Shark Tank journey?
I think the mileage we've been getting from the Shark Tank episode has been great. We closed another round after that, which is a pre-series A, which is where one of the VCs also participated. But again, from my Shark Tank experience, we focused on having more founders on our cap table. So that next round, we were able to get a few more successful Indian startup founders to join us in our journey as bringing their can, so their knowledge, expertise, and network to the Yan Bazaar.
Okay, Pratik, listen, this has been an amazing conversation, delving into all sorts of parts of your life and your journey and what makes you you. As I said at the outset, for me, it's about hoping that we can share something that will resonate with the listeners, wherever they are in their journey, some little elements of what was key to unlocking you, pivotal moments, decisions, choices you made. In the rearview mirror, knowing what you know, understanding the way the world is at the moment, the challenges people face. Let's break it up. From a personal point of view, personal development, the way you think, what advice would you give somebody who's facing a difficult choice, believing in themselves, or wanting to develop an idea? What would you say to them?
Just go for it. I mean, see, we would never know what it could unlock unless we try it, right? We can spend like countless hours discussing it with others, thinking more about it, being in those what-if situations. But we would never really be able to answer it well unless we've tried it.
Just do it. Just do it. And in terms of your journey, anything you would have done differently?
Probably everything.
You've made some critical choices, and I'm sure you might have finessed them. So it sounds like to me that your commitment to the journey, seeing it through, but you're humble saying everything you'd do differently. But is there anything particular that you'd do differently? Looking in that
box.
See,
I always feel that we keep evolving, right? So if we continue to keep evolving, we would always look back and feel that, I should have done this differently. If I were to talk about the Yarn Bazaar, I would say that maybe I should have gotten started much earlier than I did. I think I spent longer than I should have trying to either convince myself or my parents to get started on this. And I think I feel I should have done it sooner.
I can really relate to that. That the courage of your convictions, build that courage, build that through research, because you carried on your research, you carried on testing your assumption, your belief. But having the courage, and it's being brave to just do it and just go for it. So in a world of uncertainty, in a world where everybody's feeling challenges, there are no guarantees in life. We know that in every way. Mm. So for everybody out there, believe in yourself. Surround yourself with people who help you build that belief. Continue your journey of learning continuously and back yourself. Start soon. Don't worry about it on the theory table. A business plan on a piece of paper means nothing. It's all in the execution. And in your words, it's all in the execution. And on that note, I think, Pratik Gadia, I thank you very much for joining me on this episode of Just Another Lens. And I look forward to seeing you in a future episode to see where that journey has taken you and learn from that too. Thank you very much, Pratik. That's really kind. No,
thank you so much.
So that was Pratik Gadia, the founder and CEO of the Yarn Bazaar, a young man whose grandfather started in the yarn trade. His father followed that on, but Pratik wanted to do something different. He honored the traditions of his family and carried on in his father's business while at the same time he prepared for his own journey. Hopefully there'll be something within this episode that resonated with you. Please don't forget to comment and share and like. And I'll see you on the next episode of Just Another Lens.